Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for downloading. On this podcast, we'll be discussing the book Four Shots in the Night, written by my guest Henry Hemming. It's a true story of espionage, murder and justice during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. It centres around the brutal killing on the 26th of May 1986 of British agent Frank Hegarty, who infiltrated the Provisional IRA. It also involves Martin McGuinness, terrorist-turned-politician, and the notorious IRA member and British agent Freddie Scapatici, who over a decade later decided to talk to the media about what happened that night. This started a search for the truth which revealed how a handful of British agents were able to infiltrate the Provisional IRA at great personal cost. It is a period described by Henry as, by a country mile, the least understood conflict in recent British history, as well as the bloodiest and longest. And according to the commonly cited Sutton Index of Deaths, last updated in October 2002, there were 3,532 deaths related to the Troubles between 1969 and 2001. All three branches of the forces deployed to Northern Ireland under the name Operation Banner from 1969 to 2007, and it was the longest continuous deployment in British military history. The army was there at the request of the Unionist government of Northern Ireland in response to the August 1969 riots. Its role was to restore order, and the army took control until the mid-70s when the RUC assumed primacy to assert the authority of the British government in Northern Ireland. The counterinsurgency involved the army supporting the police in carrying out policing duties and also guarding key points, mounting checkpoints and patrols, carrying out raids and searches, riot control and bomb disposal. More than 300,000 soldiers served in Northern Ireland, and at the peak of the operation in the 1970s, about 21,000 British troops were deployed. We've covered aspects of Op Banner on the podcast before, and I recommend, if you haven't, to listen to pod number 7, where we discuss what it was like to be a soldier on operations in Londonderry in the 1980s, 2 years after this factual account takes place, and pod number 44, where our guest talks through his journey from soldier to joining the RUC first as a uniformed officer and then as a member of E4 Alpha, the covert surveillance unit of the RUC. Full disclosure before we start, I served two tours of Northern Ireland, one in Londonderry and South Armagh in the late 1980s, and again in South Armagh in the early 90s. Don't forget to like, follow and share details of the podcast and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts from. It doesn't take long and helps bring it to the attention of a wider audience. Finally, if you enjoy the content, you can help with ongoing costs like website hosting and buy me a virtual coffee via a link in the show notes. Let's crack on. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Henry. Can you start by telling us a bit about your writing career?
Yeah, I can. And thanks for having me on the show. So, Four Shots in the Night is my new book, and it's my seventh non-fiction book. And I've been doing this now for just over 17 years, which sounds like a long time when I say it like that. And most of the books I've written have been about intelligence and espionage. Basically, I write about spies. But until now, most of the stories I've been doing have been set in the Second World War. So I wrote a book about someone called Maxwell Knight, also known as M, the famous MI5 spy master. And he was operating during the 1930s, 1940s. Then I did one about someone called Bill Stevenson. And he's sometimes known as the man called Intrepid. He was in America during the Second World War. He was the MI6 chief over there. But Four Shots in the Night is different. It's focused on the death of a spy in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. It's different, but at the same time, there are definitely similarities to the other things I've written about. I mean, what I've come to realize is that there are common themes in the experience of a spy in 1930s London and 1980s Derry, Londonderry. So it's been really interesting finding some of those common themes and similarities.
And that human element is always there within a spy, and that doesn't change from, as you say, Roman times to contemporary times. Human element, there's all those human foibles and human issues involved.
Absolutely. And I always remember an event I did, which was chaired by the former Director General of MI5, Jonathan Evans, or Lord Evans as he now is. And I was talking about Maxwell Knight, and one of the questions was, essentially, this is all very interesting, but this surely has nothing to do with espionage today in terms of technical surveillance, in terms of digital communications. And I was about to answer when Jonathan Evans stood up and said, actually, I'll take this one. And he said, it is the fundamentals of what Maxwell Knight was doing in the 1930s are exactly the same as what's going on today. Yes, the technology has changed, but as you say, the human element remains almost unchanged.
As you've already alluded, we're going to be talking about the Troubles, which is a generic term, a very understated term, I think, for the campaign in Northern Ireland from 1969 to 2007. And what did the Troubles mean to you growing up and later as an adult?
Good question. I mean, I was born in 1979, so I grew up in the 1980s. And the short answer is I knew very, very little about what was going on in Northern Ireland. I remember hearing about IRA bombs. I remember hearing about bomb scares. I still have this vivid memory at a young age of watching TV and Gerry Adams appearing on TV with his voice dubbed by an actor. Don't even remember that for about two, 3 years that law was in place. And the thing I remember about that is just the feeling in the room that I remember thinking, this guy is having an effect on everyone around me. Something here is wrong. But beyond that, I didn't know the details. As an adult, the Troubles in Northern Ireland remained a huge blind spot in my understanding of British recent history. So I came into this project, into Four Shots in the Night, very much from a position of ignorance. And the only advantage to that is that I came into it without strong preconceptions. I was coming at it from first principles.
I think that's important because in the warm-up, I freely admitted to you that my background as a soldier who served in Northern Ireland, who had friends killed over there, it's very hard for me to take an unambivalent view about it. I am prejudiced, I admit that freely, because of my own experiences. So I think somebody like yourself who comes without that baggage is very, very useful. We'll get into that a little bit more in the podcast because you certainly opened my eyes about a few things.
Yeah, I mean, I should also just add at that point, I came into it thinking, great, I'm coming at this afresh, I'm neutral. But at the same time, I'm not neutral. I've grown up in and around London. I've gone to C of E schools. I've sung Anglican hymns. I definitely acknowledge that I'm likely to have a bias towards the British soldiers, the British spies, and perhaps to Protestants. So I've just tried to be aware of that while I've been researching it.
And something that we've talked about in past podcasts is the violence of that campaign's forgotten about, not just on the island of Ireland, Northern Ireland, but it travelled as far as Gibraltar, Germany, where British soldiers were killed off duty, and the huge bombing campaigns on mainland UK.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, when I was in tour in Northern Ireland, the British public only ever heard about soldiers or security forces being killed. But every day in Northern Ireland, you would get a thing called the NIREP, Northern Ireland Report, which was an army document. And that would just tell you all the violence that went on in the province that day. And every day, that NIREP was huge, from soldiers and policemen being wounded, unexploded bombs being found, weapons finds. So what the public saw on the news, beneath the surface of that, there was a whole load of other stuff going on. So it's a time that's been forgotten. I think your book coming out is a timely reminder of what it was actually like.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And the I think the statistics, the numbers you always hear of 3,500 people killed during the Troubles or 50,000 people injured, I think a lot of the psychological pain can get lost when you look at those numbers by themselves. Because as you say, it's the drip feed. It's having incidents on an almost daily basis over such an extended period of time that even if, I mean, I was looking at the numbers for the number of people killed in Ukraine in the first year and a half, and that's 10,000. You could say, look, that's 3.5 times more than were killed during the entire Troubles. But the difference in the Troubles is that it was more intimate. It was closer. You had situations in which IRA, ASUs would be targeting people, in some cases where they knew the victim. And if they didn't know the victim, they might know the victim's family, and they continue to live in the same area as the victim's family. And that is, it creates a very different kind of conflict.
Yeah, it was almost, and very nearly became a civil war at times. And you look at things like the American Civil War, still has echoes through to this day, and Northern Ireland does as well. I remember reading a couple of years ago that at one point, Northern Ireland was assessed as being one of the most traumatised countries in the world due to the Troubles.
One of the things that amazed me during the research in this book, in terms of the future, is getting a sense of how many schools today in Northern Ireland are integrated. And I was amazed by the number. I mean, can you guess what the percentage is?
Is it fewer than 20%?
6%, which, and that's, therein lies a big part of the problem. But yeah, you're right about the psychological damage.
Well, it's interesting because I grew up in the west coast of Scotland, and the west coast of Scotland had all the sort of the issues that Northern Ireland had, but the people there stopped short of shooting and bombing each other. You know, the schools were separate. You had orange lodges in the marching season, same as you did in Northern Ireland. You had the hate at the football matches between Rangers and Celtic. So that sectarianism was always there on the west coast of Scotland, but just stopped short of becoming a conflict like it did in Northern Ireland. So your book is about the intelligence war in Northern Ireland, and specifically the use of agents who played a massive part in infiltrating the Provisional IRA. And the scope of this infiltration can be seen in the intelligence provided. It should be noted, however, that it took the security forces from 1969 to the mid-70s to organise itself and optimise operations against terrorists. This included the form of specialist army units like 14th Intelligence Company, also known as the DET, the Force Research Unit, FRU, which is a prominent part in your book, who dealt with agent handling, and the army unit that's very famous for carrying out counter-strikes against terrorists, the SCS. And the police and the RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, also had their counterparts, and that was the Special Branch for Agent Handling, E4 Alpha, which was the surveillance side, and the HMSU, which was the armed response. And these proved a potent combination to fight terrorism. And going back to the discussion Henry and I just had about intelligence sources, what proves the importance of human intelligence is that 60% of all intelligence during the campaign was provided by agents and informers. But there's a difference that should be noted between agents and informers. Agents were paid, but informers were usually casual, and they provided information over a short period of time, which is usually about ordinary crime. And again, we talked about the human factors in agents. It's something that Henry might get into later on when we start talking about specifically people in his book. But agents are normally motivated by ideology, revenge, or they can be coerced or turned by the government forces. More importantly, though, what was called a Green Book agent, i.e. a well-placed member of the IRA, is estimated to have saved 37 lives a year. But these were top people who are a tiny portion of all agents. It's estimated over the course of the Troubles, an estimated 16,500 lives were saved by using the agents, though their use has often been controversial both in law and the manner they were deployed. Looking at the other intelligence sources then, 20% were technical. And this is through things like tapping telephones, cameras. They use a process called weapon jarking, which was putting little trackers into weapons and arms dumps and then following the weapons round. 15% surveillance by human operators, and that could be the old-fashioned way of lurking in bushes or tailing cars. And 5% were what it's from called framework operations or open source. And this is an often neglected part of the overall picture. And this was usually provided by soldiers and policemen on the ground. I remember when I was out there, you had a list of faces you had to memorise of known IRA players. And if you saw them out in the street, you were logging their movements, you would stop them and question them. There's a massive early computer system called Vengeful, which tracked all the cars. So this framework operations actually provided a very important part of the overall intelligence picture. I think we sort of slightly touched on it, but can you just tell us what made you want to write the book and an overview of the book?
Sure. I was all set to write a very different book about a Second World War spy and had the subject lined up. I had begun to write a proposal. But then I had a conversation with someone who said to me, worse the effect of, you realise that the biggest story in British intelligence from the last 70 years is about spies inside the IRA. And I remember they also said, something very similar to that was the reason why the Troubles ended when they did. And that piqued my curiosity. I was intrigued. I was skeptical to begin with. And I wanted to find out more about this. I began to do my research. I began to go to the archives. I began to read as much of the secondary source material, memoirs, histories that I possibly could. But crucially, I was also able to start speaking to people with experience or people with memories of being in Northern Ireland. And that opened my eyes to the possibility of writing about this. But there still wasn't a book there. The moment I realised there was a book was when I heard about the story of Frank Hegarty. And he was a particular agent who was working in Derry, Londonderry. And I think what made me understand this could work was that the story of Frank Hegarty seems to bring together all the different themes of the story of British intelligence during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And it's also a story that moved me. I think if you're going to spend 5 years writing about a subject, you need to have some kind of emotional attachment to it. So this was, I found it a very powerful story, one that I wanted to tell that I thought more people should be aware of, but also one that I thought was able to bring to life this much bigger political story. I mean, I'm trying to find the personal in the political. That's always what I'm trying to do when I'm writing, and this story seemed to do that. But it also brought us right up to the present day, because at the heart of this story is the possibility that Frank Hegarty, who was being run by the FRU, the unit you mentioned earlier, could have been killed by another agent who was also being run by the FRU. And this led to a police investigation which began in 2016 called Operation Canova. And this has become the largest murder investigation in British history. It's got 72 detectives. It's cost £40 million. It's had hundreds of interviewees, tens of thousands of documents. And it's an enormous operation. And this is focused on the activities of this army agent and whether or not he could have been involved in a series of serious crimes, i.e. murders. So that's how I came to this story.
I talked about the motivation of people who become agents. Why did Frank Hegarty become an agent, in your view?
There are different theories on this. And one theory is that he was involved in an attack in the 70s on a British army base, and two people were killed, two local Catholic, a man and a woman. Two people were killed. And one theory is that when he was approached, the person who approached him appealed to his idealism, appealed to his desire to make things better in the region, to end the violence, said there might be a bit of money in it. But at some point in his pitch, also brought up the fact that Frank could have been involved in this earlier attack. So if that is true, then there's an element of blackmail. In other words, you need to work for us. Otherwise, we'll try and use your involvement in this attack to have you put in jail. I think in reality, they didn't have remotely enough evidence to link him to this particular attack. So there wasn't a real threat. But even just bringing that up during the initial conversation could have helped to just sway him a little bit if he's wavering, if he's not totally, totally sure. So I think he was inspired partly by a desire to make sure that part of his past didn't come back to bite him. But he was certainly, and this is an account which has been corroborated by one of the people involved, he was certainly driven by an idealistic desire to end the violence. His attitude towards the violence had changed. And back in the early 1970s, he joined the official IRA. He became involved. But since then, he'd become a dad, become older. His priorities had changed. And he saw this as a way of helping to bring peace to the region.
And he was a bit unusual in that he wasn't your typical Republican. He didn't live in the hardcore area like the Craigan or the Bogside. And he was also married to a Protestant. So he doesn't really fit that mould in
exactly
a lot of respects.
Yeah. He's almost the opposite of a typical young IRA volunteer. And in a way, that's what's so clever about it. That means he's one of the last people you'd suspect. He's living with a Protestant woman. He's much older. He's a little bit overweight. He's not someone who's you're going to hear down the pub talking about the need for a united Ireland. He's much more interested in greyhounds. He's a greyhound man. This is a big part of his life. He's training greyhounds. His friends are all greyhound men. That's his world. So he was taken on really as an access agent or an eyes and ears agent, someone who can just pass on things he's heard down the pub, on the street, from his friends in the greyhound world. And for the first 4 years of his career as an agent, that seemed to be it. That seemed to be all he was going to do. But this is an important part in the story, in Four Shots in the Night. It all changes when MI5 realise they don't have enough sources close to McGuinness in the Derry, Londonderry area. And they ask Frank's handlers if they can repurpose him. And by that, I mean, they've got to ask him, Frank, can we find a way to get you into the IRA, into the local brigade? And the story goes that when he first heard this, he said, effectively, you've got to be joking. That's never, ever going to happen. I'm the last person they'd ever take in. But he agreed to have a go.
And Martin McGuinness is like sort of the golden thread throughout this, the prize for the security services at the time.
Mm.
And also, in a lot of respects, the point of your book, and we'll discuss that a little bit more. But for people that don't know, Martin McGuinness is a lead provisional IRA player. He was a butcher's boy, but a very astute man, not stranger to violence, and ruled Londonderry, Derry with an iron fist. And people were very, very scared of this man.
Mm.
And he came to prominence quite early. I mean, for example, I read in your book that in 1972, he's involved in talks with Willie Whitelaw. He's one of him and Adams flown over to the UK to have these political discussions. What was the aim then of the security forces in MI5? Why was it so important to get somebody close to McGuinness?
Some people will tell you that McGuinness was an agent working for the British from the start of the Troubles. I've had someone look at me and swear blind that he was taken on in 1968. I don't believe that. I don't believe he was a paid-up agent working for the British at any point. And I think that for most of the 1970s, the British didn't see him as hugely important. They didn't see him as someone to focus on. But in the late 1970s, that began to change. And by the early 1980s, certainly, there's a lot of interest in McGuinness within MI5. And one of the things I found in the archives that I found absolutely fascinating was a letter from senior MI5 officer to Margaret Thatcher as early as 1981. So this is during the second hunger strike. And in it, he says, I haven't got the quote in front of me, but he says, where's the effect of, we are considering the idea that it could be efficient to try and persuade McGuinness and Adams to move to a political approach. In other words, these are the guys that we think could have the potential to become political leaders, who could be the people to bring the IRA away from violence towards a peaceful resolution. And what's interesting is that in most other histories, people imagine that shift happened much, much later, so late 1980s. But here you have a senior MI5 officer, not just talking about it within MI5, but actually suggesting this in a letter to 10 Downing Street. So clearly from the beginning of the 1980s, this is an idea that has currency within MI5. They're interested in McGuinness because they think not only he has the leadership to be trusted within the IRA, people respect him, people will follow what he does, but they also think, and this is based on just their judgment of his character, they think he's someone who's not totally wedded to violence. They think he's someone who, deep down, would quite like the idea of becoming a political leader. And you can't say that about all senior IRA figures. There are other people, someone like Ivor Bell, who's never going to want that, who only sees physical force as the answer. He's only interested in bringing in more explosives, more weapons, and trying to escalate the military campaign. And although McGuinness is ruthless, he's absolutely committed to the military campaign, MI5 realized that he seems to have the potential to be swayed to do something else.
Around about this time, the IRA announced the strategy of the Armalite and the ballot box. Mm. Were these two things related, or were they both separate initiatives? Or did MI5 see, they're talking about Armalite and ballot box, that's our way in to try and make this suggestion?
I think they did see that as their way in. You have, Armalite and the ballot box, just to explain it, is essentially the political and the military. Armalite is, can we just force the British out of Northern Ireland? And the ballot box is, can we become an established political force that people vote for, and they vote for in such great numbers that eventually we become the dominant force in Northern Ireland? And it's worth pointing out that Sinn Féin, in 1981, refused to take part in any elections up until the very end of that year when this announcement was made, and suddenly, headline news, Sinn Féin is going to put up candidates for election. And this is a big, big development. I mean, the idea is so interesting to think about what's happening today. The idea that there would one day be a Sinn Féin first minister in Northern Ireland, if you'd said that to someone back in 1981, they would have thought you were absolutely bonkers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yet here we are. But for MI5, back in 1981, this is a way in. And are they two separate things? They completely relate to each other. And from an MI5 point of view, what they want to do is make the military option as hard as possible and the political option as easy as possible. And this is not a totally new concept. And when you look around the history of the disintegration of the British Empire during the 50s and the 60s, you see a very similar thing happening. And this is straight out of the British post-imperial playbook. I'll give you one example. In Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta, was first detained by the British. He was labelled a terrorist. And he was later then befriended by an MI6 officer, and he eventually became the first leader of an independent Kenya. And this basic tactic of selecting an enemy insurgent or an enemy leader, someone who's very much working against you, but singling out one who has the potential to become a political leader, and then out of sight, quietly, winning them over, not taking them on as an agent, but winning them over and steering them towards a political path. That's something that the British have done many times. And it would have been strange if they hadn't thought about doing the same thing in Northern Ireland. So as far as we can tell, something like that began to form in the minds of MI5 officers around this time.
And the third sort of central character in the book is one that's extremely controversial. It's Freddie Scappaticci.
Yes.
Another IRA hardliner, a member of the notorious Nutting Squad, which was the IRA enforcement unit that dealt with informers and disciplinary matters. Can you just give us an overview of his part in this story and his relationship with both Frank Hegarty and McGuinness?
Absolutely. He's a Belfast 69er, meaning he joined the IRA right at the start of the Troubles. He is someone with a violent streak. He's got a short temper. He is proud of the fact that he's been interned several times. And in about 1976, he gets kicked out of the IRA. He's been sounding off about some local IRA leaders, and he's taken outside a pub. He's beaten up. He's told he's no longer in the IRA, and he's furious. He is desperate for revenge. And at around this time, he has a conversation with a soldier called Peter, and this soldier wins him over. They become friends. And it sounds unlikely, but it was a very skillful recruitment. It wasn't part of an elaborate strategy which had been carefully thought out beforehand. It was a friendship which eventually led to Scappaticci rejoining the IRA. And then once he'd rejoined the IRA, he was asked to join the Nutting Squad. And from there, the story becomes suddenly darker in the sense that the allegation is that he was asked to take part in a number of executions, a number of interrogations, and we don't know yet exactly which ones he may have taken part in. But he was certainly part of the Nutting Squad, and he was certainly close to a large number of murders and kidnappings and interrogations. However, during this period, he was also able to provide a staggering amount of intelligence. And his position within the Nutting Squad allowed him this incredibly intimate understanding of what was going on inside the IRA. And he was providing both tactical intelligence and strategic intelligence. So sometimes the Nutting Squad would be involved in operational security for an IRA op that was coming up, in which case he'd know about the attack, he'd know where the bomb was being planted, which army unit was going to be attacked. He could pass that on to his handlers, and 9 times out of 10 he did. But he also was close to figures like Gerry Adams. And famously, Scappaticci would often drive around Belfast at night with Adams sitting next to him. And his car was wired for sound, had microphones all over the place. So the British had these fantastic recordings of Gerry Adams talking about what was going on, talking about his thoughts, his fears. And apparently these tapes were often played to visiting politicians such as Margaret Thatcher to show her this is how much information we have. So Scappaticci saved a lot of lives, but he may have been involved in taking some too.
Yeah, I think in his book you say he may have been implicated in 50 murders or more.
That's one of the numbers that gets thrown around. And I didn't really answer the second part of your question, which is what's the connection between Scappaticci and Hegarty? And it's simple. It is that Scappaticci is believed, he was accused of having killed Frank Hegarty. And this is really the question that runs through Four Shots in the Night. Could Scappaticci have been the one that did this? Was he just close to the person who did? Did he try to save Hegarty's life or not? It's a question that I leave unresolved until the very end of the book. So maybe I'll keep my powder dry on this one a little bit.
I think we'd ruin the book if we went any further down that lane. But just to want to clarify about Scappaticci, this wasn't a chance encounter by this army soldier, Peter, because if I remember rightly, Peter was a member of the FRU, is that correct? So it was a targeted operation. Oh, right, okay.
He was actually just, he was with the D&Ds, the Dorset and Devonshires, if I've got that right. And he was a battalion intelligence, I can't remember the exact term, but he was not part of the FRU at that time. but his job was simply to try and take on agents as and when he saw fit. He knew a special branch police officer who was already running Scappaticci, but he was not running Scappaticci to get information about the IRA. He wanted information about builders in the building trade who were carrying out or taking part in a VAT tax scam. And that's the kind of information Scappaticci was initially providing. But during one of these debriefs, he brought in Peter. Peter and Scappaticci hit it off, and they agreed to meet up again. And after a series of meetings, Peter then managed to turn the relationship into one that was officially handler and agent. But it took a long time. It took a lot of skill. And Peter never actually became part of the Fru, as far as I'm aware.
No, it's interesting because, just for listeners to be aware, I went back to that intelligence source piece at the start that I said, well, 5% was framework operations. Mm. And it wasn't unusual if you were in a permanent vehicle checkpoint, which was usually near a border, or even in a routine patrol, you'd stop someone and they'd offer information up. Mm. And obviously, you'd have to make out that you're just treating them as a normal member of the public and not taking too much of an interest, and you'd take their details and you'd then hand that to your regimental or battalion intel, intelligence cell, where the likes of this Peter chap worked, and then they'd pass it on up the chain to whoever would then be interested in looking at cultivating this person as a source of information or acting on that information. And bearing in mind, everything about this type of warfare or campaign, everyone's got to be treated suspiciously. It might be a plant for some reason. You know, it might be false information that these people are giving out. It's a very, very murky world. One thing you alluded to during this conversation is how you deal with agents and the compromises you have to make. And you used a phrase in your book that I hadn't heard of before, and that was a spy master's dilemma.
Yeah.
Can you just sum that up for listeners, please? Because I think it's a really good indication of the problems people face.
The spy master's dilemma is essentially, as a handler having received intelligence, the dilemma is, am I going to save more lives if I act on this intelligence, or am I going to save more lives if I do not? And on the face of it, that sounds crazy. You know, surely if you have intelligence which suggests a bomb is going to be planted in such and such a place tomorrow, then you have to act on it because that's going to save more lives. But the difference here in this particular situation is that in Northern Ireland, during the Troubles, most of the time when a piece of intelligence like that came in, it could only have come from one person. So if you were to act on it, you're going to endanger the life of your source. That source would very likely be taken aside by the Nutting Squad, interrogated, and most likely the order from the IRA Council, Army Council, sorry, would come for that person to be killed. You, of course, as a handler, you have a duty of care towards your agent. You need to do everything you can to preserve their life. But the other thing that skews the dilemma and makes it harder is the possibility that if you do nothing, then your agent will become more trusted. And in the future, they're going to receive more information, which could be more valuable, which could allow you to save more lives.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
And I guess the other thing to add, I mean, I'm talking about this in a slightly abstract sense. Most of the time, you never have the full picture. You never have the full picture. You never know precisely what's going to happen in the future. So you're making a decision based on a calculation, which is based on a speculation. It's incredibly hard. And the added difficulty is that you have time pressure. you usually have to make this decision in a very short space of time. So I think one of the things I was really blown away by when researching Four Shots in the Night is understanding just the difficulty of those decisions and just how many of them had to be made during the course of the Troubles.
You talk about those time pressures. We've got a podcast with a former friend of mine who left the army, he joined the RUC, and he did the selection course for E4 Alpha, the surveillance unit. And he talks about later on in his career, he's taking part in a desktop exercise for senior police officers. And you used to have mainland police officers attending these training exercises. And he described a situation whereby the playing out a scenario, a call comes in, there's a bomb being placed here. We've got evidence of a kidnapping about to come here, a planned shoot here, and all these scenarios all coming in, six or seven different scenarios, all happening within 24 hours. And he said you could see these mainland police officers being overwhelmed. Yeah. And one of them said, this is not realistic. You know, we deal with one kidnapping a year.
Yeah.
And these RUC officers saying, this is not unrealistic for the situation in Northern Ireland. This is almost a day-to-day occurrence, all these different things. So you've got to then allocate your resources to task, and you've then got extremely short time frames to make these decisions. Mm. So it's a very, very complicated operating environment.
Yeah, it's hugely difficult. I often think the easiest way to think of this, the kind of the dilemma that these handlers face, is to try and sort of break it down into the moral side of it, into the military side of it, and then into the legal side of it. And it's the three very different ways of coming at it. Because from a military point of view, you know, was it right to have so many agents either inside or close to the IRA and other paramilitary organizations? From a military point of view, that's easy. Yes, it was. If you're a senior military commander and your task is to neutralize the local IRA to help the police to bring peace to the region, this is one of the most effective and efficient ways to do that. But of course, from a moral and ethical point of view, it's much, much harder to make those decisions. And I guess the one thing that became really clear when researching this book was that the people who had to make the decisions often didn't have enough support or training or understanding of exactly what they could and could not do, which takes us to the legal side of it. And this I found amazing, that there simply was no law covering exactly what you could do as an agent handler in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. I'd naively assumed that there would be, that there'd be some clear set of legislation describing what was possible. There was there's one moment that sort of sums up this lack of legal certainty, the way that people were being forced to operate in a legal no man's land. And that moment is when a senior special branch officer, someone called Ray White, goes to see Margaret Thatcher. And this is something like 1986. And he says to her that he has agents that are doing things that could technically be construed as criminal acts. What should we do about it? There needs to be legislation. And the reply from Number 10 Downing Street was, and I quote, "Please continue to do what you're doing, but for goodness sake, try not to get caught." And that, to me, sums up the attitude and the stance. It's this idea of, we don't know what's legally okay, but just try not to get caught, and hopefully no one will ever get to find out about it. And what's interesting is that 30 years later, you have Operation Canova, and suddenly, it's not that they have been caught, but suddenly there is a series of police officers looking at everything that happened from a very different perspective. So the attitudes changed enormously between the 1980s and the present day.
It's interesting, because in your book you write that one in three of the most senior people in the IRA were close to or being run by a handler or case officer. Mm. Also, it's hard to find another conflict where spies have ended a conflict as decisively as Northern Ireland. And I think that choice not to have that legal framework was obviously deliberate. But again, what really knocked me off my feet in your book was that legislation about covert human intelligence sources, well, it's called the Covert Human Intelligence Sources Code of Practice, wasn't brought until 2022.
I know. And what's so amazing to remember is that back in the 1980s, MI5 and MI6 did not officially exist. I mean, today you can follow the head of MI6 on Twitter if you like. But back then, there was still this enormous veil placed over the security services. There was this, I mean, some historians think it's a very British thing, this attachment to secrecy, that it's this almost fetishistic attachment to the whole idea of it. And there were other countries in Europe at the same time who did acknowledge that they had intelligence agencies. But in Britain, we were much slower to do that. A lot of that comes down to the attitude of Thatcher at that time. And she had a very deferential attitude towards MI5 and MI6. She wanted them to be able to do their own thing. She would always increase their budget. She did not want there to be legislation describing exactly what they were and what they did. So yeah, it feels like a sort of a world that's hard to imagine sometimes.
And another thing I found interesting about was that you described at the start of the troubles in Northern Ireland, where a posting to Northern Ireland for one of the security services was seen as a death knell.
Yeah, exactly.
But 10, 15 years down the line, it became a desirable posting because it was quite a high career profile for them. So it's interesting that how that flipped.
Yeah, it's a really interesting shift. It's partly to do with the character of MI5. So back at the beginning of the Troubles, it was a much more military-minded, right-wing, conservative organisation. A larger proportion of the people working in there had been in the army and had retired from that and moved into MI5, saw it as something to kind of finish out their career. And they were more interested in finding Soviet spies in London. They wanted to infiltrate trade unions. They didn't want to get inside the IRA. That was someone else's problem. They saw the Troubles as simply a security issue. They thought the army and the police should be dealing with it. They thought the IRA leaders should be locked up or engaged on the battlefield. And what's interesting is that, I mean, just as an aside, meanwhile in MI6, you've got a very different attitude. And in MI6, they're going out there from the beginning of the Troubles, trying to engage the IRA leadership, trying to find a way to achieve dialogue. And so you have these two almost sort of polar opposite approaches from MI5 and MI6 during the 1970s. But then it changes for MI5. And part of the reason is there's a new director general. He comes in the late 1970s, Howard Smith. He's a Foreign Office man. He has more of an MI6 approach to these things. But it's also to do with a new generation of MI5 officers coming through the ranks. People like Stella Rimington, Stephen Lander, both of whom go on to become future director generals of MI5. And they're less interested in just chasing Soviet agents around London. They see what's happening in Northern Ireland as important, and they believe that intelligence can make a difference. And so suddenly, exactly as you say, they're queuing up to go and work in the joint section over in Belfast.
So we've discussed the moral ambiguities there. I'll put you on the spot now, Henry.
Mm.
Did the end justify the means?
I think it did justify the means. And it's taken me 5 years to arrive at that judgment. I think the end justified the means because if there had not been those spies inside or close to the IRA, two things probably would not have happened. Number one, the IRA would have been able to continue to operate for much longer. And instead, largely as a result of having so many agents close to or inside the IRA, by the late 1980s or the early 1990s, there are a number of units and IRA brigades which effectively come to a standstill. And there's obviously some of the more rural units are harder to penetrate. They can keep going. Some of the cells in England, same thing. But in places like Derry, Londonderry and Belfast, you have a situation where the IRA is basically coming up against a brick wall. It's no longer able to be militarily effective. But the other thing that changes is that Sinn Féin has become, by the same time, a viable political force. And this is something I had not understood before I began to research Four Shots in the Night, is that MI5 had agents inside Sinn Féin, and they weren't telling these agents, do whatever you can to mess things up. They weren't telling these agents, we need to slow the growth of Sinn Féin. They were doing either the opposite or they're saying just don't mess things up. They wanted Sinn Féin to succeed at the polls. They wanted Sinn Féin to be a viable force, because only when you had that could there be some kind of negotiation between the unionists and the Republicans as represented by Sinn Féin. So there's two shifts occurred, and I think intelligence played a critical part in each of them.
It's interesting as well, because I hadn't heard of this, but there's a thing called Operation Chiffon, which started in the early 90s. And this was aimed to bring about a ceasefire and political discussion. Mm. What you alluded to there with agents in Sinn Féin was just that. Don't disrupt, be enablers rather than disruptors. Mm. And I think Op Chiffon, if I'm right as well, was about giving Adams and McGuinness as representatives the most realistic chance of achieving peace through a variety of means. And to the extent that assassination attempts on Adams, for example, were interdicted by the security services, where some people might think, oh, it'd have been easier just to let him be taken out. So I found that very interesting, that there was actual, that grand strategic thinking over a long period of time where you pick your people and you look after them.
Mm. And it's a fascinating story, and I highly recommend also, there's a new book that came out last year by Peter Taylor called Operation Chiffon. And it's a fascinating account of that process. And you're absolutely right. Both McGuinness and Adams were protected physically, and McGuinness certainly was kept out of jail. There was a large police investigation into McGuinness, and the local police absolutely thought, this is it, we've got him. And this is to do with the murder of Frank Hegarty. And they believe they had enough information to link him to this murder. However, MI5, or not specifically MI5, but they were told to bring this investigation to a close because it might impact the peace process. A peace process which at that time nobody knew about. So there were these incredibly secretive negotiations that began to take place. And the reason this all began is to do with one MI6 officer taking a risk. One man who, Michael Oatley, decided to have a conversation with Martin McGuinness. And this is because of a relationship that Michael Oatley had developed with a local Derry businessman.
And a lot of this was off the record, wasn't it? Absolutely. Not official business.
Yeah. And he wasn't meant to be having this conversation. And he knew that if he'd gone to his superiors beforehand and said, my plan is to sit down with Martin McGuinness and talk for 4 hours about the future, they would have said no way. Because the official position of the British government at that time was there's to be no interaction between Crown servants and members of the IRA. But his friend was prepared to take a risk, and he put him in a room with Martin McGuinness. Technically, Michael Oatley should have left that room immediately, but he decided not to. And that really was the start of the peace process.
As I said to you before, I'm really torn with my own experiences with Northern Ireland. And I went back there about 14 years ago, and I've mentioned this in a few of the podcasts. Mm. And I went there thinking the army had been sold out and a lot of people had been killed for nothing. And when I went to Belfast that time, I realised that a flawed peace was better than no peace. Mm. And this all ties in with these moral ambiguities that we've been talking about now. The fact that, you know, McGuinness was kept out of jail, the security forces did stuff that was bordering or was illegal. But I think I agree with you, the end justifies the means, because the level of violence and death and destruction over there was absolutely horrendous. But as you did your research and you're writing your book, what were your thoughts of the role McGuinness, whose journey from terrorist to politician is, in my mind, astonishing? What do you think about his role in the Troubles, and how much did he and Adams contribute to the ceasefire?
I mean, I'll start with the last one. They contributed a huge amount to the ceasefire, but they also contributed a huge amount to the conflict that came before that. And of all the people I've ever written about, Martin McGuinness is the hardest. I think in a very broad sense, when you're reading history, when you're reading any kind of story, even when you're listening to the news, we're pretty accustomed to the idea that someone is either good or bad. You can be good and flawed, you can be bad and flawed, but you're usually one or the other. Martin McGuinness was not only extremely bad, but he was also capable of being extremely good. He was brutal, he was merciless, he was responsible for a huge number of killings during the Troubles, and not just from a distance, I mean, often of people that he either knew personally or he knew the family. So this is a cold-blooded man. And at the same time, later on in his life, he is the one who is pushing for the IRA to move away from war. There are other people in the IRA who are desperate to keep going. He fights back against them. He agrees to work with Ian Paisley. He agrees to meet the Queen. He does a huge amount to not only bring about the peace, but also to maintain it during the decade that follows the Good Friday Agreement. So he is, as I say, a really difficult character to write about. And I think to sort of understand, you have to be able to hold in your head at the same time two totally different understandings of what a person can be. And for some people, that's impossible. Some people, he's an amazing, peaceful politician, and that's the end of it. Or indeed, he's a brutal murderer, and that's the end of it. But I think the truth is he was both.
Mm-hmm. You sort of, I won't give too much away because it's in your book. I highly recommend people read it. But there's a bit in your book where he almost seems to repent at one point towards the end of the book about some of his actions. I got a sense from what you were writing that he was starting to be a bit more introspective about his part in the Troubles. Was I reading that wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. And I found that really moving, actually. It seems to have been triggered by the moment when he runs for president. He tries to become president of the Republic of Ireland. And at the very beginning of this race, he's in pole position. He's the favourite to become president. And every time he's asked during an interview, while he's on the campaign trail, if he's asked about his IRA past, he just brushes the question off. Just says, I'm not going to talk about that. I'm here to talk about the future. And about 2 months into this, before everyone goes to the polls, the family of Frank Hegarty work with the Daily Mail to write a piece about what happened to Frank and McGuinness's role in Frank's death. And suddenly, the story about McGuinness is again about his IRA past. And this has a domino effect. This leads to other people coming forward. Other people are asking McGuinness about his role in other murders or assassinations that took place. And he ends up finishing in fourth, and his presidential campaign falls apart. And it seems to be that in the years after this, he becomes able to engage with what he did. And he starts saying things like, I regret every single one of the deaths that took place during the Troubles. And that's not something he would have dreamed of saying earlier. So it does seem to be a huge shift, and it does seem to have been brought about by what happened during that presidential campaign. And as I put it in the book, I think he realised that in order to go forward, he had to also go back. And up until then, he'd tried to just leave the past and tried to just pretend it hadn't really happened. But he realised towards the end of his life that that wasn't possible.
On page 249, you state that the IRA were never defeated, which surprised me. As an organisation, they were severely compromised, as we've already discussed. And you write that by the early 90s, 8 out of 10 IRA operations were being interdicted or called off, with known IRA player Brendan Hughes saying, I think that's what this technology did and what the intelligence sources were able to do. I think they were able to effectively stop the IRA and contain it. And as you mentioned earlier, you had active service units in South Armagh that were virtually impenetrable to the security forces because of the way they operated and where they were. I'm just curious, as you think, why they were never defeated?
I think it's to do with that word defeat. I mean, what I'm arguing in the book is very, very close to defeat. Severely compromised. They failed in their stated aim. But for me, defeat implies surrender. Implies, I'm thinking Germany 1945, Japan 1945, where what's left of the leadership comes forward and says, we give in, we can't go on anymore, and we will accept your terms. And I think it's significant that that did not happen. That was one of the concessions that the British government decided to make. That's at the heart, really, of the Good Friday Agreement, that there wasn't this moment where the IRA had to admit defeat and surrender. But I mean, from a military point of view, there's not a huge difference in either whether it's defeat or whether it's severely contained. The organization is not able to be an effective fighting force in the way that it had hoped to be. But I think I'll stick to that, that it was not defeated, only in the sense that there was no surrender.
No, I mean, I've been a bit pedantic there, because when I first read it, I admit I bristled.
Former
soldier.
I could see that.
But once I calmed down and you realise, and exactly as you very well framed there, I can see why you made that statement. But ultimately, the winners are the people of Northern Ireland, because that violence stopped. Don't get me wrong, I'm not naive. There's a lot of violence under the surface over there. There's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes, and I fear that it wouldn't take much to bring it to the surface again. Whether the general public of Northern Ireland would put up with it to the level they did before, I doubt very much, but the violence is always there.
Absolutely. It's interesting to think about what has changed and why there isn't that same tolerance of violence. And in some ways it goes back to the root of the Troubles. And I think it's easy to forget. You imagine that the Troubles began as simply a campaign for unification, for Northern Ireland to be part of Ireland. And of course that wasn't true. It began as a civil rights campaign. And it was a series of people, mostly Catholic, but Catholic and Protestant, who were campaigning very simply to end discrimination against Catholics in Northern Ireland. It was about housing, it was about votes, it was about jobs.
Social issues.
Exactly. And that's how it started. And because a lot of that discrimination has gone, I'm not going to say that all that discrimination has gone, but most of it has, I think that's why there's less injustice and there's less grievance and therefore less tolerance for violence.
I found the variety of people you talked to very, very interesting. So I'd be interested to know how you conducted research and what was it like talking to such a wide variety of people, from the security forces via terrorist victims and former members of terrorist organisations?
It was an education. It was an experience that allowed me to learn a lot about interviews and how these kinds of interviews work. And I think the main thing I learned was the importance of being completely honest and transparent about who I am and where I'm coming from. And I think when I have written other books, most of the work has been in the library or in the archive. And when there have been interviews, who I am doesn't really come into it. It's sort of fairly obvious where I'm coming from. But with this subject, with Four Shots in the Night, it was much more important. And I learned that it's, the only way you can come into an interview when you're talking about something in the Troubles is to be upfront about roughly where you're coming from and what you believe. And I guess the other thing that I learned is that most people have a story and they want to tell it. And if you can get into a situation where they're comfortable talking to you and it's off the record, you can learn a lot. I guess the other thing I learned was just about trust, that no one's going to talk to you until they trust you, and that sometimes that trust can take a long time to build up. I mean, there was one interview that took, I think it was 2 years to set up, and it was worth the wait. Other interviews would take 30 seconds. But again, it's always about that basic calculation. Can I trust this person? Who is this guy with glasses and a beard who's talking to me about the Troubles? I found it moving. I found it fascinating. I found it extremely informative.
You might want to take the Fifth Amendment on this one. I know we're not American, but you know what I mean. But did you have an MD knocking on your door or phone you up saying, from either side, saying, Mr. Hemming, you might want to just back off from there?
I didn't have anyone saying that. I did have one situation, which I'm happy to put this on the record, where I had an interview with Operation Canova, and I imagined that it was going to be an opportunity to talk about the history of Operation Canova and what had been going on. But it very quickly became clear that actually I was the one being interviewed, because they'd heard something from someone else about something that I knew, and they wanted to know who my source was. So that was one of the more interesting moments in the whole process. And again, it's taught me a lot about the importance of maintaining your integrity, and if an interview is off the record, then it remains off the record forever. And that's something I learned early on.
What, in your opinion, does the future hold for Northern Ireland?
Oh, it's a big question.
It's probably very, very unfair, Henry, but yeah.
I mean, I'm always wary of anyone who feels they can answer it. I mean, what is the future of Northern Ireland? What I could do instead is just tell you some things that really struck me about Northern Ireland today, which has surprised me. I don't know what the future holds for Northern Ireland. I do know that I've been surprised by how the question of whether Northern Ireland remains part of the UK or becomes part of Ireland is less potent than it was 40 years ago, that young people in Northern Ireland are less animated by this question, which says something about what life in Northern Ireland is like today. I guess I'm also still surprised, I brought it up at the beginning of the interview, by just how separate life can be in Northern Ireland. The lack of integration in schools, for example, is, I think, a really big, big issue. And I mean, the other thing, and this is not original, but the other thing that really strikes me is that the attitude of senior unionist politicians is one that's holding the cause of unionism back. And it doesn't necessarily reflect the beliefs of all Protestant people in Northern Ireland. And I understand where a lot of those politicians are coming from. I understand the world in which they've grown up in which any kind of concession is a surrender, is a defeat, is a really something you're constitutionally averse to doing. And at the same time, it's making unionism a much less attractive force. It may all be hastening the unification of Ireland. So that's one of the other things that's really surprised me, and I hope that changes in the future.
Listeners can see from this conversation, and MD, who knows a little bit about the troubles of Northern Ireland, it never is a zero-sum game. It's all about compromise, and some of that compromise is murky and some of it's painful, but you know, if you dig your heels in, you're never going to achieve anything.
Yeah, this is true, but it's certainly the story that I find most amazing in this is just the journey that Sinn Féin has been on from polling, I think it was 8% in the very first election that it took part in the 1980s, through to being the largest party in Northern Ireland today with a Sinn Féin First Minister. That's an amazing story. And what's even more amazing is the role that MI5 agents might have played in that. And I think that's a fascinating part of the history.
Well, most importantly for listeners who hopefully have had their appetites whetted, where can they get a hold of your book? It's due out on the 28th of March, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, you're right. And it is available from the usual suspects, Amazon, your local bookshop. And it's also going to be an audio book, which when the recording starts very soon, actually, no, the recording will have happened by the time this podcast comes out. And there's a brilliant actor called Jamie Parker who is going to be doing the audiobooks. So if you like your audiobooks, I'd highly recommend that. And he played Harry Potter in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child on stage, if that that helps bring people in. Basically, he's got the voice that I wish I had. he's
I don't know that feeling. I hate listening to myself. I hate listening to myself on podcasts. So what's your next project? Are you taking a rest or are you straight into it?
I've got a few ideas, but I haven't settled on one of them. But I've got three or four ideas that I'm just beginning to look into. But at the moment, I'm all out with promoting Four Shots in the Night and talking about this.
Fantastic. As usual, we'll finish off with Desert Island Dits, which is the guest choice of book, film and luxury item if they're marooned on an island. So what have you picked for us, Henry?
So my book choice is In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. And this is the book that, that made me want to write in the true crime genre. And this book is...
Set off a whole genre in itself, didn't it?
Absolutely. It was an amazing book. I mean, some of the writing in there is just sublime. And I know there are problems with some of his reporting. There are problems with some of the ethics of what he did and the possibility that he actually wanted the death sentence to be passed just so that he could finish the book, which is deeply problematic. But at the same time, it's a hell of a book. And he has an extraordinary capacity for sympathy and understanding. And to anyone who hasn't read it, I'd recommend it.
Can you just give people a quick overview, Henry? Because I think it's quite important just for what you've said there. Just set the picture for that so they know it.
It's the story of a murder which involves two petty criminals. And it's the murder of a family. And I think what the book does is it gets right inside the heads of the two criminals, how they plan it, how they go about it, and then also the kind of the justice that follows their time in prison and their search for some kind of salvation and redemption towards the end. And it's the first time someone had written a book like that, which got so close to a murder, but did so in a non-fiction way, as in this is all real. This is based on his extensive interviews with the two murderers. And maybe you don't learn quite enough about the victims, but you certainly come away with a strong sense of who the people responsible were. So it's an amazing book.
I think as well that the story behind the writing of the book is absolutely fascinating, because Capote was a very urbane, I think, was he a New Yorker?
I think he was.
Urbane New Yorker. He was gay. He had a really unusually high-pitched voice.
Yeah.
And he turned up in the middle of Midwest America, I think that's where it was. And it's just that clash of cultures as well. He caused a stir wherever he went, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
And didn't care.
I know. And I'm just trying to think if there's any kind of parallel to what I've been doing, writing and interviewing a huge range of people. I think sometimes when you're a complete outsider to a subject, it's easier for people to talk to you. And I've certainly found that with when interviewing people in Northern Ireland or people who have experience of working there, because I'm not, let's say, a unionist politician. I'm not someone who served in the army. I'm not any of these things. It can open people up. And I think that's a part of that book.
People don't feel threatened by the person sat in front of them.
Yeah.
Film choice, Henry?
So I found this one tricky because I feel like my favourite film seems to change every few months, depending on what I've seen most recently. But I rewatched recently something called Shadow Dancer, which is an amazing film. It's got Clive Owen in, Andrea Riseborough, and it's about a spy inside the IRA. And I think it's fantastic. It's quite rare to have such a good film about spies inside the IRA. And fingers crossed, something similar will happen with Four Shots in the Night. It's just been optioned by Jed Mercurio. He did Line of Duty and Bodyguard. And hopefully there'll be a TV series coming out soon, which will be very, very exciting.
Can I just make one request when you're overseeing the production?
Yeah.
Please get a decent military advisor in, because they never get the berries right.
Colin, I'll sign you up. make sure the berries are right.
Please make sure that I'll be on top of you, Henry, saying, Henry, we talked about the berries, mate. We talked about the berries. Now, my wife's a midwife, and we can never watch a joint army midwifery thing together because it just gets slagged off.
I love it. Yeah, I can imagine.
So my choice this podcast is Henry's book. I absolutely flew through it. I was lucky enough to get a preview copy. I learned an awful lot from it. It tied up a lot of loose ends for me. It made me do some hard thinking, as I've already alluded to during this podcast. And it's certainly a different take on a theme that's little known about. So please go out there and give Henry's book a read, because it's really, really worth it. That's it for another episode. Henry, really enjoyed that, mate. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. I really enjoyed it too.
Thank you. And thanks again to the listener for your continued support and suggestions. Please keep them coming, and our email and social media links are at the bottom of the show notes. You can find us on all the usual suspects, including Instagram, Facebook, YouTube and Twitter. And if you download us from iTunes and like the podcast, it'd be great if you could leave us a review there or anywhere you get your podcast from. And thanks again to Nick Beale for his continuing help and offering technical support for his company ISAR. And we'll see you next time on The Unconventional Soldier.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.